Good evening, and welcome to tonight's monthly teleconference entitled MS Research Update. All lines are currently in a listen-only mode. During the presentation, we will conduct several question-and-answer sessions. If you would like to ask a question, please press 1-4 on your telephone keypads. Please try to ask questions that are general in nature and that might appeal to the larger group. And please keep your question to under 1 minute. Questions will be taken in the order that they are received. Please note as well that this conference is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to Ms. Piper Reynolds, Senior Manager of Outreach and Education for the National MS Society Greater Northwest Chapter. Piper, you may begin.
Okay, thank you. And I'd like to thank everybody for being on the call with us this evening for our October monthly teleconference. This teleconference is one of the many free and helpful chapter programs and services available to people living with MS. From support groups to care management, financial assistance to political advocacy, we are here to help and partner with you. Whether you are a person living with MS, a friend, or caregiver, the National MS Society is here to connect you to the information and resources you need. Contact us by calling 1-800-344-4867 and press 1. Research in MS is progressing at a remarkable rate with more potential therapies in the pipeline than at any other time in history. During tonight's interactive teleconference, you will learn about cutting-edge research projects and findings around multiple sclerosis and receive practical advice based on these findings from our featured guest speaker, Dr. James Bowen. Dr. Bowen is a neurologist and the medical director at the MS Center at Swedish Neuroscience Institute. He joined Swedish in January of 2009 after previously serving at the MS Centers at the University of Washington and at Evergreen Medical Center. Dr. Bowen is a board member for the National MS Society and has also served on the chapter's Clinical Advisory Committee, chairing the committee since 1999. He is also on the National's Clinical Advisory Board of the National MS Society and chairs the Scientific Peer Review Committee, C, for the Society. He was inducted into the National MS Society's Volunteer Hall of Fame in the Health Professional and Researchers category in 2005 for his contributions as a volunteer. Dr. Bowen's research interests include issues of aging and a variety of aspects of MS research, including clinical trials of treatments. He is also involved as a peer and ad hoc reviewer for numerous publications and has authored more than 200 articles, abstracts, and publications relating to MS and other neurological diseases. For those of you living in Washington State, Dr. Bowen and other experts from the MS Center at Swedish team will be traveling to Yakima on October 15th for a special program called the MS Roadshow. This program will cover a variety of aspects around living with MS, including exercise, sleep, mood, sex, and more. Join us and register by calling 1-800-344-4867 and press 1. Following this evening's teleconference, you'll receive a program evaluation by email, which we urge you to complete, as your feedback and ideas are very important to us. Within that email, you'll receive information about our upcoming teleconferences and other programs and services available to you. On that note, I'd like to thank you again for being on the call this evening and would like to hand it off to Dr. Bowen. You may begin, Dr. Bowen.
Thanks, Piper. Tonight, I thought that I would cover three areas related to MS research. The first topic will be our work on trying to stop the disease. The second would be what is being done to try to restore function that has been lost. And the third is what is being done to try to find the cause of MS and end the disease altogether. I thought what I would do is speak on each of these three topics for about 15 minutes, and after each topic have a five-minute break for questions. So if you jot your questions down, then I will stop in about 15 minutes and give you a chance to ask those. So first, talking about what is being done to try to stop the disease. We think that MS is primarily related to inflammation where the immune system attacks the brain. And most of our attempts at slowing down the disease are directed against the immune system as a result. We have several treatments that are on market already. And the first of these came on market in 1993. We now have four interferon medications, We have glatiramer acetate, Tysabri, mitoxantrone, and the new one, Gilenya. So this is really a remarkable speed with which medications have been developed compared to other diseases. I thought I would briefly touch on some of the three studies related to existing medications. The first is related to Gilenya. The other name for this drug is fingolimod. Gilenya has been on market at almost exactly 1 year now. This is the first oral medication that has been released to treat MS. It has been very successful. It has been showed a nice decline in disease activity with decreases in the number of attacks people have. It's also shown a benefit with less disability developing over time in patients on the medication, and it's shown a decrease in MRI activity. So all of the three major outcomes that we look at in research have been positive with this medicine. It has had some side effects, but these have been fairly manageable. One is that it decreases the pulse rate on the first time that you give it, so that patients have to be monitored for about 6 hours in the doctor's office during that first dose. Subsequent doses don't have as much problem in that regard, so they don't need to be monitored for those. Another problem is that a small percent, less than 1% of people, can get swelling in the back of their eye and the retina, and because of that, we have to get an eye examination before we start the drug, and then again 3 to 4 months afterwards. We also need blood tests before starting the medicine. I bring this this treatment up because it is an example of success of the research that has gone on over the last few years, and also an indication that we're starting to move into medications that are easier to administer. Another existing medication is Tysabri. This medicine is given once a month and has been on the market for several years. One concern with Tysabri is that a very small percent of people, about 1 in 1,000, develops a virus infection called PML, progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy. PML is caused by a particular virus called JC virus, and this virus normally lives in the kidneys. It crops up from time to time. Once a person has it, you really never get rid of it. But your immune system keeps it at bay. But from time to time, it crops up. The immune system takes care of it. However, if the immune system is not able to take care of it, then this virus can spread and get into the brain and cause a brain infection, which is what PML is. It's a very serious infection and can be fatal. In fact, in cases treated with Tysabri, about 30% of cases have been fatal with this. Previously, we had quoted risks of about 1 in 1,000 for this drug of getting PML, but recently studies have shown that there is a blood test that can predict the risk of this. If a person tests positive on the blood test, it means that they have had the JC virus in the past and likely still have it now. Those patients' risk would actually get worse. Rather than 1 in 1,000, it would be more like 1 in 500. If a person tests negative on this blood test, it means that they have never had that virus, and their risk of getting the disease is extremely low. Our estimates are that it's 1 in 10,000 now. So this this blood test has just become commercially available in the last few weeks, and we now can use that to estimate what the risk is of patients getting this PML infection. About half of patients would test negative on this test. For that half of patients, they can really take the medicine without much fear of this infection. A third line of research to comment on is we are still struggling to try to figure out which medication might be best for each particular patient. Right now, it's done by just guessing which one fits a patient's lifestyle the best. But I want to mention that there is a study called CombiRx that has been underway for about 3 years now. This study, a quarter of the patients are on Copaxone, a quarter of the patients are on Avonex, and half of the patients are on both Copaxone and Avonex. This study will probably have results coming out in the mid part of 2012, next year. It should give us information about how these drugs stack up compared to each other, but also whether a combination of two drugs might work better than one. The other interesting thing is that the patients, when they started this study, had a gene chip run, which looks at about 500,000 genes, and they can tell which genes are active and turned on and which ones are not active and turned off. It's hoped that by looking at these, we will find a pattern of which genes are turned on that might tell us how to predict which patients might respond to one of these drugs versus another one of these drugs. So this may be our first real ability to tell which particular drug might work for a particular patient. Next, I want to talk a bit about some of the upcoming medications that are in studies. There are several in the pipeline, but some that warrant further comment are nearing coming on the market. One is called BG12. Incidentally, probably all of these drugs are going to have different names when they come on market. They'll have to pick a brand name that's easier to pronounce. BG12 has two studies that are in phase 3 trials that are underway. A phase 3 trial is the big study that is done that if it's positive, the drug can come on to market after that. The first of the BG12 trials is called the DEFINE study. This study, they looked at several different outcome measures, and one was the number of attacks that people had. And this outcome was decreased by half in patients treated with the drug. They also looked at disability, which decreased by 38%, and they looked at MRI activity, which lessened by 85%, or if you look at the number of lesions that enhanced with the dye on the MRI, that decreased by 90%. These results are quite impressive. And they balance against the fact that this BG12 is an oral medication that has very few side effects, with the main one being some GI discomfort, but no serious side effects. A second study will need to be done to get this approved through the FDA, and that study is underway. It is called the CONFIRM trial. We expect the results from this will probably be out near the end of this year or early 2012. Another medication which is in the pipeline is lecanemab. This medication is a relative of a previous medicine called lenalidomide. Lenalidomide looked very promising for MS, but when they did the big phase 3 study on it, it turned out that it caused blood vessel inflammation, which led to a few heart attacks. They scrapped lenalidomide and went and looked back to try to figure out what the problem was, and they were able to change the chemical structure just a little bit and change it into lecanemab, which turns out not to have that problem. Lecanemab causes changes in the immune system in a number of different ways, and increasing cells that are likely to not cause inflammation. It also decreases the chemical signals between cells in the immune system so that they're not as inflammatory. And it decreases the number of white blood cells that go into areas of the brain that would cause damage. There are two studies that were done on this drug. The first was called Allegro. That showed a decrease in the relapses by about a quarter, and it showed a decrease in disability by about 36%. It also showed benefit on the MRI scans. A second study has just recently been announced. This one is called Bravo. This one also showed a benefit for all three of those outcome measures, disability, annual relapse rates, and brain MRI. One problem with that study is that when they looked at the raw data, the outcomes were not statistically significant, meaning that you couldn't be certain whether those findings were because they were true or whether it was just chance. They then realized that the MRI scans of patients in the treatment arm and the placebo arm were not balanced, with one group having a lot more MRI spots at baseline than the other. They had planned to look at this before they started the study, so when they looked at it, they corrected this and rebalanced the two groups. And when they looked at it with balance between the baseline MRI, then the outcome was positive. So this drug looks like both studies have been positive, and the company is now talking to the FDA about this, and we hope that in the next few months it might gain approval on the market. One curiosity about this drug is you might have noticed that the relapse rate, the medication helped that about a quarter, but the difference in disability was better than that. This is really the only medicine that has been looked at in MS that had a better outcome for disability than it did on the relapse rate, and we're not sure why that is. Another medication is one called teriflunomide. This one also has recently been, the results have recently been announced. This study is called the TEMSO, T-E-M-S-O study. teriflunomide is really a mild chemotherapy that prevents cells from being able to reproduce rapidly. It does not affect cells that reproduce slowly. So one of the groups of cells that reproduces rapidly is white blood cells, and this medication decreases those. It has shown benefit at decreasing relapse rates, decreasing disability, and decreasing MRI, just like all the others. It had a few side effects, which were relatively mild. This includes nausea, diarrhea, and some mild hair loss. A second study is underway, the TOPIC study. This is looking at people who have had a first attack of what might be MS. We call that clinically isolated syndrome. And we expect results from this in about a year or so. A couple of other medicines to mention. One is called alemtuzumab. This is a medicine that is given a bit differently than all the others. It is intravenous. And you give it once a day, usually for 4 days, and then you're done for a year or so. You can then redose a year later. So it's sort of a once a year medicine. There is a major study called CARE-MS-1, which has been done. And that one, they compared this drug to Rebif, so a head-to-head study between these two. It showed that it decreased the attacks by half when compared to Rebif. And Rebif, of course, already decreases the attacks that patients have. So the effect of the alemtuzumab is even greater than half if you were to compare it to placebo. It also showed some benefit on MRI activity, although the effect on disability was really not that different between the two arms of the study. The problem with alemtuzumab has been side effects. There's an increase in infections with this drug, and also a quarter of people get a thyroid disease called Graves' disease. Graves' disease, when it affects the thyroid, causes a low thyroid, and you can usually address that fairly easily by just putting the patient on thyroid replacement. The more concerning issue is that occasionally it will affect patients' eyes, and it will cause tissue to build up behind the eyes, and this causes the eyes to sort of bug out. Barbara Bush had this a number of years ago, and people like the comic Marty Feldman had this. The eye problem can be difficult and expensive to treat. Another issue is that about 3% of people get something called immune thrombocytopenia purpura, or ITP. ITP is a condition where your immune system attacks your platelets. Your platelets are the cells that causes your blood to clot, so people can get bleeding as a result. This is treatable, but there was one death on the study in a patient that did not come for his follow-up care, and so he did not find out that he had ITP until it was too late. There is a second study, CARE-MS2, which is underway on alemtuzumab. So after the results of this second study are available, then they will have to decide whether they're going to go to the FDA or not. I'll mention one other medication, cladribine. Cladribine was slated to be the second oral medicine released to market, but both the European agencies and the FDA turned this medicine down because there were concerns about the side effects of it compared to the benefit. So that drug has now been withdrawn from the market. Finally, before we get to the questions, there is a study on primary progressive MS on fingolimod, that's Gilenya. This study has recently completed enrollment and will run for about 3 years. So perhaps in 3 years we'll know whether this medicine is helpful for primary progressive MS. Finally, there are two studies of secondary progressive MS that are underway. One is with Tysabri, and the other one is a medicine called rituximab, which eliminates the B cells from the bloodstream. The B cells are the ones that make antibodies. That study is being done through the National Institute of Health. So we hope that in the near future that we will have results, and we're hoping they'll be positive for both primary and secondary progressive MS, as well as the relapsing remitting ones we have. Finally, before we get to questions for this section, I comment that there are probably more studies being done for drugs in MS than any other disease. My slides, I have a listing of about 75 drugs that are currently in human studies for MS, and there's probably a similar number in studies for rats and mice. So I think it's a very rapidly moving field. We're going to have drugs that are easier to administer with fewer side effects in the near future. So with that, I'll open it up to questions. We'll try to do 5 minutes of questions or so. So if you press 1-4 on your phone, then the operator can connect you for questions.
And our first question comes from the line of Jane in Wasilla, Alaska. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, thank you. I'm interested in my situation and others too, that I was diagnosed when I was 22. I'm now 59, and I took beta zeron for about 14 years, but for the first 10 or 12 or 14, I didn't do anything, of course. And I went off beta zeron, and I was having some emotional difficulties, and my MRIs were negative for enhancing lesions, and so I switched to Copaxone and then went off that, but I've decided in the last couple of weeks I want to go back on it, and have been advised to do that, not by my doctor so much, but the research I've done, and looking at the fact that it might be better to let things ride out here until something better comes along, maybe. My doctor hasn't said, yes, you have secondary progressive, but the main thing is my MRIs really haven't changed, but yet, you know, I'm getting along more in disability issues. And so what, when you don't have enhancing lesions anymore, maybe is it best to go off these drugs and just wait and see?
Mm-hmm.
Or are they neuroprotective in some way?
Right. Well, it's probably important to realize that the enhancement on the MRI just means whether you have an attack of MS going on that day. The enhancement will go away within just a few weeks. So having an MRI that has no enhancement does not mean that you haven't had any disease activity up until that time. If you do see enhancement, that's particularly worrisome because it means that the disease is definitely active because you can see it right then and there. Whether patients, most patients continue to treat their disease with some medication. We know that the medicines aren't perfect. They don't completely stop the disease, but they definitely slow it down. And patients that are on treatment do better than patients that are off. The big unknown, or one of the big unknowns, is what to do with secondary progressive MS, where they're no longer having attacks so much, but just slowly getting worse. There have been several studies of secondary and primary progressive MS, but in general, they have not shown a benefit to the medicines. But we're not sure whether that's because the medicines simply don't work or whether they do work and we just can't measure it. The reason it's difficult to measure is that people with primary progressive and secondary progressive don't have attacks as much as the relapsing remitting. So you cannot count attacks, and you have to use the disability as the outcome measure. And our ability to measure disability in MS is not very good. So we have to use that EDSS scale, which is a pretty crude scale, and it sometimes it may be that the scale is just not accurate enough. So a lot of our patients stay on medicines, even though we're not entirely sure whether it's helping or not.
And our next question comes from the line of Karen in Benton City, Washington. Please proceed with your question.
Yes, good evening, Doctor.
Hi.
It's lovely to hear your conference tonight. My oldest daughter has one question for you, my daughter Samantha. She's 18, and her question to you is, how would her mother know if she has the secondary progressive MS? I've had MS now for some 30-odd years, and as time goes by, my ambulatory is getting weaker. My mind is still very positive to try and get over this rotten disease, but it seems to be winning, and on the days when I'm not very strong physically and mentally, I have to give in to it, which drives me crazy because I'm a mother of three and I really, really don't like this condition. I don't want any part of it. And so getting back to my daughter's question, can that be answered, or is that just a personal how I feel?
Yeah, it's really... When a person switches from relapsing remitting over to secondary progressive, there's not a like a day that that happens. It kind of creeps up on you. The secondary progressive, what that means is that the baseline is no longer stable. So people are just kind of slowly losing ground over months in the absence of attacks. So they could have attacks that cause them to worsen, but they're also getting worse in the absence of those attacks. It's really entirely on the patient's history as to when that happens. But as I said, it kind of creeps up on people. And probably there's a component of this progression in most cases, but just the cases that are mild enough, it goes slow enough they don't recognize it. There's big debate in the field right now of whether that progressive component of MS, whether that's due to low-level inflammation with the immune system still attacking the brain. If that's the case, it would be responsive to immune-directed therapies. Another thought is that it could, rather, it could be due to the nerves just having so much damage done in the past that they just can't maintain themselves, so they die off in the absence of inflammation. And, of course, if that was the case, we would not, the treatments that we currently have would not help that. And we don't know which of these two possibilities is correct. There is a lot of research going on trying to figure it out, but to date, there just isn't any answer to that. One final comment is that a lot of people worry that if they have progressive MS, that that's a particularly bad thing. But I think it's important to realize that the rate at which the disease gets worse is the same for people with progressive or relapsing remitting forms of the disease. So it really does not tell you prognosis. It really tells you just sort of what style of worsening a person might have, whether it occurs as acute attacks or whether it's just more kind of a slow loss of things. Maybe time for one more question, and then I'll move on.
Certainly. Our next question comes from the line of Jackie in Burien, Washington. Please proceed with your question.
Hello, Dr. Bowen. I happen to be your patient,
good.
Which I'm very glad to be. But I did have one question on the delinium or the phlegomide. Am I pronouncing that right?
The one pretty close.
Ratio. Could you repeat again what the side effects of that?
That are So the main side effect is it can slow the pulse rate. It does that for about 6 hours after the first dose, and then subsequent days it's less and less, so that by the time you get out to 2 or 3 weeks, there's no effect on the pulse anymore at all. The other is about 0.4, so 0.4%, 4 out of 1,000, get swelling of the back of their eye that has to be followed by ophthalmology. And then we follow at baseline, we check the blood counts to make sure that people are ready to, that their system is okay with that medication. Otherwise, there's not a lot of side effects. Some people, very slight number, get diarrhea, but that generally they adjust to that pretty fast. So it's pretty well tolerated. The main issue is that it is a new medication, and there could be unknown side effects, but it's been on market a year now, so there have not been any surprise side effects so far, so we're feeling a bit more confident about it now. Let me move on to the second segment here about restoring what has been lost. And I think we all realize that if we had some magic medicine that would just put a stop to MS, we would still have people with disabilities because of the damage that's already been done. There are several avenues that scientists are looking at to try to repair that damage. One of them is looking at the immune system. We think of the immune system as being a bad part of MS, and in fact it is, because it's contributing to the damage caused by the disease. But it turns out that some components of the immune system are also beneficial. helping either remove debris from an area that's been damaged or else actively promoting repair in the brain. One of the ones that is particularly interesting is that antibodies have been found that seem to promote remyelination. This was done by the group at Mayo Clinic, where they have access to a large blood bank of patients that have a cancer called multiple myeloma. And this particular cancer makes huge quantities of a single clone of antibodies. They screened hundreds of these of blood samples from these types of patients and found two of them that seemed to promote remyelination, at least in a mouse model. These are now being evaluated to see, they will soon move them into human trials to see if it can help with remyelination in humans. Other groups are looking at some of the immune cells, like the lymphocyte chemicals that lymphocytes make called cytokines, which might be helpful, and others at macrophages, which are sort of the garbage disposal units of the immune system, to see if they may be helpful. All of these are a ways away from coming into human trials, though, at this point. Another strategy is looking at growth factors. Our bodies have a number of chemical signals that tell cells to reproduce or not to reproduce, and each different organ has different chemical signals to tell it what to do in this way. There are growth factors that tell myelin to reproduce and make more myelin, or the cells that make the myelin to reproduce. One of the challenges is figuring out which of these chemical signals might be the best ones to use to give in humans. One problem is that there isn't just one of these growth factors. There are perhaps 50, some of them telling the myelin to reproduce, others telling it not to reproduce. In adults, on balance, it's rather strong in favor of the myelin not reproducing because our brains don't need to get any bigger than they are now because there's no additional space inside our skulls for it. So they've looked at some of these growth factors, and if you give one that tells the myelin to reproduce, then the other 49 just rebalance so that you end up with nothing happening. There's therefore working on combinations of these factors to see which combinations might be most effective in this regard. Some of these, especially one called Lingo, is nearing or starting in human trials, actually. So we expect in the future that there'll be several more of these coming down the pipeline. Now, the final way that people are looking at restoring what is lost is looking at stem cells. So I thought I'd spend a few minutes talking about stem cells. There are really three types of stem cells when we talk about these. One is a bone marrow stem cell called a hematopoietic stem cell. These are cells that are committed already to making blood. They make red blood cells, white blood cells, that whole the whole lineage of blood cells. This is what people use nowadays when they do a bone marrow transplant. There are studies of bone marrow transplants in MS, and these are not really designed to repair the damage. They are designed to give a high dose of chemotherapy that essentially kills off the immune system, and then replacing it with these bone marrow stem cells, which can repopulate the bone marrow reconstitute the immune system. This strategy is sort of like pushing the reboot button on your immune system. Another type of stem cell is called mesenchymal stem cells. These stem cells are really used not to make other cells, but to make chemical signals. And different mesenchymal stem cell lines can be engineered to produce different signals. Some of these signals are ones that would cause the myelin to reproduce and repair. But other of these signals are ones that would control the immune system to try to regulate it better. There are a couple of studies in humans of mesenchymal stem cells, one by a company called Celgene, which uses mesenchymal stem cells derived from placentas. This study was a phase one study, so first time that it's been done in humans, and it just finished, so we don't have the results from that study yet. Another mesenchymal stem cell is being studied at the Mellon Center in Cleveland and was recently on the news a few weeks ago. Now, the third type of stem cell is an embryonic stem cell. I think a lot of people don't really understand where these cells come from. When an egg is fertilized, it starts reproducing and making dividing into more and more cells. And by 8 to 10 days, it's formed into a sphere about the size of the head of a pin. This ball is hollow in the middle, and in fact, the fluid in the middle is what eventually forms the amniotic fluid. There's a little clump of cells on the side of this ball, and that has 32 cells in it, and these are the embryonic stem cells. So we're talking about 32 cells. You can get these at 8 to 10 days after fertilization, but if you wait even a couple of days, then it's too late. These cells are no longer capable of growing into any cell line, and they're already committed to particular tissues, like one would grow into muscle or bone, for example. But if you get it 8 to 10 days, they can grow into any tissue that you might want. These embryonic stem cells have been key to learning how to manipulate these cells and make them grow the directions that we want them to grow. For example, in MS, we want them to grow to make myelin. Kidney doctors want their embryonic stem cells to grow into kidneys. However, there's a problem scientifically with embryonic stem cells in that they're not that many cell lines. Since these cells are different than the patient that you might want to put them into, you would have to get a cell line that would be a perfect match for the patient, just like you'd need to match a kidney transplant, for example. So there's so few embryonic stem cell lines that the chances of a patient actually matching one of those is pretty slim. Where the field is going more recently is something called an induced pluripotent stem cell. This is an adult cell that you take from the adult patient and you change it so that it starts behaving like these embryonic stem cells. So we use the embryonic stem cells to learn how to work with these cells, but nowadays the push is more toward developing cells from the patient themselves that we can then alter and make behave this way. One way of altering them is you can put different genes in the cells. A study that was done a few years ago took four genes and plugged those genes into a virus, and they infected some cells in a culture, in a petri dish, and those four genes turn those cells into embryonic stem cells. Those four genes are master control genes that turn on many other genes. This was really a big breakthrough, but it's not something that we could use in humans because it has that virus in there. And if we gave those cells back to a human, that virus would just spread and infect many other cells in their body. And you would have embryonic stem cells cropping up all over the place. Another strategy is to take the nucleus out of a fertilized egg and replace it with another nucleus. For example, you could take a fertilized rabbit egg and pull the nucleus out of that and plug a mouse nucleus into that cell, and you could get a mouse embryonic stem cell line as a result. This also has not been done for humans because of the concern about diseases or viruses spreading, and then the ethics of mixing species like that. An even more promising strategy recently is to put RNA in a cell. Remember, the DNA in a cell programs the cell to make RNA, and RNA programs the cell to make proteins. And that's how our genes control our bodies, is through RNA, which makes proteins, and the proteins control our bodies. It turns out that RNA only hangs around for a few hours once it's made. So they found that they could inject certain RNA fragments into cells and use those to turn it into a stem cell. That RNA has been destroyed within a few hours, but the stem cell, the cell's already changed its behavior into that of a stem cell. So you can get a stem cell that way without leaving any genetic traces or viruses or anything else. The remaining issues with stem cell research are that we need to find a good source of these stem cells. And as I said, the field is really moving towards being able to get those cells directly from the patient. Some of the tissues like bone marrow or fat or skin cells are quite readily available. Another challenge would be to learn how to direct those stem cells so that they grow in the direction we want, so that in our case we get myelin from that. We also need to make sure that the local environment in the brain is able to accept these stem cells so that they're able to patch the areas of damage. And then finally, we need to make sure that they are safe to use and that they don't turn into tumors or something like that. Right now, there really are not any of these embryonic stem cells that are being done in humans. There are a lot of stem cell places offshore in foreign countries that are advertising, but really none of them have been shown to really be injecting stem cells or to really be doing this in a way that we can ever prove that it would be of value to the patient. I think the real stem cell studies are going to be done a few years down the road. It's unclear exactly how long that might take, but we think it's actually on the relatively near horizon, perhaps in the five-year range, although I'm hesitant to get pinned down to that. So, in conclusion, and before we have questions on this section, there are at least three strategies, immune system, growth factors, and stem cells, that are being looked at now to restore the damage or restore the lost function. And I think in the near future, we're going to see a lot of progress in that line. So with that, I'll open up and see if anybody has questions about this topic.
And as a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, you may register for a question by pressing 1-4 on your telephone keypad. Our next question comes from the line of Benjamin in Marysville, Washington. Please proceed with your question.
Oh, sorry, hello?
Yeah, there you are.
Oh, yeah, you already answered it, actually. You talked about it.
Oh, good.
Sorry, and our next question in that case will be a follow-up from Jackie in Burien, Washington. Please proceed.
Hi, Dr. Bowen. I somehow got cut off on the first session of medications that you described and the research that was going on. But my question overall really goes with both sessions. Are there any medications or any research being done to help with the walking other than the medication that's currently available? Or will these drugs that are in the test phase or just help all over us MS symptoms? Is that the direction, or is for specific disabilities from MS?
Yeah, most of the drugs in development right now are directed against slowing down the MS itself, but there actually are several studies being done to try to improve symptoms from MS. We have one drug that's on the market now called Ampira, or dalfampridine is the generic name for that. And that drug is designed to increase the speed that people walk. It probably improves a number of symptoms, but they had to pick one to study, and they chose walking speed because you can measure that one readily. So that drug's on the market. It helps about 30% of people. So if you're in that 30%, that's great. And if you're not, then it doesn't really help. Within the 30%, the average person increased their walking speed by about 25%, which actually can make a difference if you're trying to get to the bathroom in a hurry or across the street in a hurry. There are other medications similar to Ampira, which are being developed, and at least one of them is in human studies right now. There are also different forms of medicines, a couple of them that are being studied to treat spasticity with the muscle stiffness right now. So a lot of people are working on these symptom treatments as well as the treatments to slow down the disease.
And we have another follow-up from Karen in Benton City, Washington. Please proceed with your question.
Yes, hi, Doctor. Slightly different from subject, but is there a test that I can have my three children take to see if they're predisposed to getting MS?
Right. There are no good ways to tell if a child is predisposed to MS. The risk, if a parent has MS, the risk of a daughter getting MS is between 3 and 5%, and the risk of a son getting MS is between 1 and 2%. So the risk is fairly low, but there are no tests that will tell you whether they're at risk. If they already have MS, of course, you could do an MRI to look for that. You might think that you could do an MRI before they get symptoms, and if you saw a bunch of spots that that they would have MS, but that turns out not to be the case, because MRI scans, normal people have spots on their MRI, and it goes close to your age. So if you're in your 20s, about 20% of people would have some spots on their MRI. So if you were, say, testing a daughter and did an MRI on a daughter who had no symptoms, you have a 20% chance of and your daughter was in her 20s, you'd have a 20% chance of finding some spots just normally, or a 5% chance they would have MS. So it's actually, if you do MRIs, most of the people that show spots would be normal people. So right now, there's no screening test for that. Actually, that's a good question that maybe I will just segue from that into the last segment, and then we'll end up with some questions, another opportunity to ask questions. So the last section was trying to end MS and find the cause of it. We've been trying to find the cause of MS for decades, and in fact, the first description of MS was in the 1860s by this French neurologist called Charcot, and we've been trying to find the cause ever since then. One of the big breakthroughs occurred in the 1940s when it was discovered that MS was more common in the North than the South. Another clue about what might cause MS is it's more common in women than men. And then also there's racial differences in it, where whites get the disease much more than blacks or other racial groups. However, this is becoming increasingly confusing because the North-South difference is changing rather rapidly. The disease seems to be holding steady in the North, but in the South it is increasing, not only in the south part of the U.S., but other areas of the world like Brazil and India. areas near the equator where MS was extremely rare previously. Another thing is that with women, it's becoming increasingly a female disease. Perhaps 10 years ago, it was 70% women, and then 5 years ago, it was 75% women. If you go back 100 years, it was 75% men, and the crossover between those, it occurred gradually, but the women outnumbered the men in about the 1960, plus or minus a few years. Also, as I mentioned, the difference in races, especially between blacks and whites, where there are enough blacks in the United States to count so that you can have a statistically meaningful result, that is changing. It used to be that blacks had half of the rate of MS that whites did. But in recent, the last couple of decades, the rates in whites is holding steady, but in blacks has markedly increased, so that black women have pretty much caught up with white women, and the black men have caught up by about two-thirds. It's felt that other racial groups are having similar increases or seeing more cases in Hispanics, and here on the West Coast, more Asian cases as well. There are other studies that have looked at the risk of MS, and it seems to be dependent not only on this north-south location of where you're living, but especially where you grew up, with the risk determined before you were 15. Now, this has been studied in migration studies, where if you move say from Southern California to Washington before you're 15, then you would get the risk of the place you're moving to. But if you move after about the age of 15 or so, then you would carry the risk of where you grew up in childhood with you throughout life. They've been trying for many years to explain these various epidemiology findings, and I have a list here of some of the things they've looked at, and I'll just read it off. Trauma and diet, socioeconomic status, various toxins, including organic solvents, and welding. They looked at dogs, various chemicals, electromagnetic waves, zinc, mercury. They've looked at climate, sunlight. There have also been 13 viruses that I counted that have been isolated from MS, and we were just sure was the cause of MS, but then it turned out those were false leads and not the cause. So for decades, they've tried very hard to explain the north-south, the male-female, and the racial differences of this disease, and to date, we still don't know how to explain this, though the going theory is that it's related to some virus that we're exposed to in childhood. More recently, the direction of some of these studies has gone into genetics, and as the previous questioner mentioned, there is a risk of MS in relatives, but it's not that high, and suggests that MS is not really a genetic disease like most of your inherited diseases might be. If you have a patient with MS, there's a 20% chance that somebody else somewhere in the family would have the disease. This would include going out to aunts and uncles and cousins. If you look at first-degree relatives, for female relatives, this would be a mother, a sister, or a daughter, 3 to 5% risk. Male counterparts of that would be 1 to 2% risk. If you have an identical twin, so that you're 100% similar or the same genetically, there's a 26% chance the other twin will have it, suggesting that three-quarters or so of the risk of this disease has nothing to do with genes, but rather with something in the environment, like a virus or something. Recently, there have been huge studies that the MS Society has sponsored looking for genes linked to MS. With these studies, they've taken close to 10,000 MS patients and compared them to controls that don't have MS. And they look for genes that are more common in MS. They have now found a link to over 50 genes, but these links are not real strong. This has caught a lot of press in the news lately, but they have not found the cause of MS. In fact, these studies suggest that most of the risk of MS is not due to genetic risk, but again, something in the environment. The genes that they have identified account for only a small percent of the risk of getting MS. And in fact, the big three of these genes, by far the bulk of them, they account for only 4.4% of the risk of the disease. I think the most important point of these studies is that all of the genes that they found were related to the immune system, with exception of two that were linked to vitamin D metabolism. So this suggests that really there are no new avenues to look down in that looking at immune system function would be the most productive route. Finally, there are three factors which have been found to be linked to MS. One is vitamin D. It seems to be associated with MS, but it does not seem to be the cause. There's no question that MS patients have low vitamin Ds. This may actually precede their diagnosis, but we know that the MS itself precedes the diagnosis, often by years. It is unclear if putting patients on replacement vitamin D seems to help. There are three weaknesses in the vitamin D argument that give people pause about whether this is the cause of MS. One is that severe vitamin D deficiency is just not seen in the United States very much anymore. Our parents' generation, rickets was quite common, but I've actually never seen a case as a physician because vitamin D is now in milk and orange juice and Flintstone vitamins. So nowadays, we just don't see the vitamin D deficiency with at least bad vitamin D deficiency. Another is it's difficult to reconcile vitamin D deficiency with the marked increase in MS that's occurring in the South. And then finally, blacks have much lower vitamin Ds than whites do because the pigment blocks the sun, which helps form vitamin D, but yet blacks have less MS than whites do. A second factor is EB virus. EB virus is the one that causes mononucleosis. It's been known for a while that patients with MS have higher antibody levels to EB virus, and they also tend to be exposed to this virus later in life. So some people think that EB virus may be a cause of MS, but I think most people now think that this is just a marker of something else that might be the cause of MS and not the cause itself. This is because several recent studies have come out that indicate that not everybody with MS has EB virus. Also, if you look at patients that have their very first MS attack, you know, that clinically isolated syndrome, it's only 5.6% of them that have the EB virus itself expressed in their spinal fluid. So probably that virus did not cause that disease. There was also a recent Australian study that found that the DNA levels of this virus were no higher than it is in a normal population, but antibodies were higher. Of course, you might expect this because antibodies, the level of antibodies is determined by the robustness with which your immune system might attack a target. And we know that MS patients have revved up immune systems. So this is in some way a marker for a revved up immune system. Finally, the third marker is smoking. It's now been recognized that smoking worsens MS and causes more disease activity. There are now large studies going on trying to see how these three factors interact with the genetics of the disease. But for now, we still don't know entirely what causes the disease. But this week they're announcing the Nobel Prizes, and you know, I think there's a lot of scientists out there trying to maybe get that prize for discovering the cause of MS. So with that, I will stop and open up maybe to 5 more minutes of questions.
Okay, and we do have a question from the line of Donna in Ellisburg, Washington. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, I think it's environmental. It has to do with the nuclear reactors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually been thought of, but one of the problems with that is that the disease greatly precedes the advent of the nuclear age. For example, there's one woman, St. Lidvina, who many people think was the first person to have MS that we know of historically. She was born in 1385. And the same applies not only to nuclear things, but, you know, industrialization and pesticides and, you know, factories spewing out all sorts of chemicals. So they've looked at those things, and they continue to look at these things, but they still have not, you know, they just haven't panned out yet.
Okay. One more question. Can you take too much vitamin D?
Yes, you can. But it takes a lot, and the main side effect or the main problem if you took too much is kidney stones. So if you talk to someone who's had a kidney stone, they tell you how awful that is as a side effect. But as I said, it takes quite a bit. Here in the Northwest, it's pretty common for people to need 2,000 to 4,000 international units. Vitamin D is not measured in milligrams, it's international units. So 2,000 to 4,000 units is a pretty common dose, and some people take even more. But just to put that in perspective, if you were completely nude and you went out and lay in the sun for 15 minutes, you would get about 10,000 units. You know, even doses that high are usually not toxic. Of course, most people don't lie out in the sun totally nude, so you have to prorate that according to clothing. And then up here in the Northwest, you know, we're pretty far north, so we don't get quite 10,000 units either.
And our final question comes from the line of Karen in Benetton, Washington. Please proceed with your question.
Yes, thank you so much, Doctor, for your teleconference. You have been very informative along the lines of the sunshine. So if a person chooses to live in a more sunny state, is that more optimum for an MS patient?
There's sort of two questions. One is, like, if you did not have MS and you lived in a sunny state, would you be less likely to get it? And when they looked at that in the past, the answer was no. However, there is this north-south gradient, and if you live in the south, you're less likely to get MS. And, of course, a lot of the southern states have more sunshine, but it seems right now to be more related to how far south you are rather than whether you're in a sunny southern location. The other question is, well, once you've got MS, if you move south, would it help you? And, of course, it's too late. You've already got MS, but would you have less severe MS? And right now, we don't think it makes any difference once you have it. It's also not known whether taking vitamin D helps with the, you know, making the disease less severe. There is a study going on in Scandinavia where they are looking at exactly that question to see if vitamin D helps prevent the disease, but we'll have to wait the results of that. There is a problem with just looking at people's vitamin D levels in that if you take MS patients and just measure a bunch of vitamin Ds on a bunch of MS patients, you'll find that the higher the vitamin D level, the less disabled the patient is. But it's a self-fulfilling prophecy because you have to ask yourself, who would be out in the sun that much to drive their vitamin D levels up? And that would, of course, be the ones that are less disabled. And then the ones, the more disabled they are, the more time they spend indoors. So so the problem is one of those cause and effect, chicken egg kind of things, whether the vitamin D caused the MS or whether the MS caused them not to go out in the sun so much and therefore they have a low vitamin D. So I think that's our last questioner that we have time for, and I just wanted to thank you all for participating, and hopefully you'll be calling in for the next teleconference. So thanks.
Thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your lines.